Chapter 9 Calico Archives. The display showed that the small craft had deposited 6 well-armed soldiers on the outside of the pod. They were currently just milling around, not in any big hurry to get inside. The craft had taken station at the beacon, and one of the beings was in the process of turning it off and stowing it.
"They hit us twice, Sarah, and have installed armed guards on the IP hull."
Candace was making her point as forcefully as possible, even though it was John's point. He had simply told her that it was her argument to make.
"I think we need to bare our teeth a little bit. They need to know we aren't afraid of them."
Sarah pondered this thought. It was an escalation, but Candace did have a point. They were in our territory with guns.
"Dad, are you there?" she asked.
"No. Your dad went down to have a word with the engineers. CIC, and I think he was going to chat with the cadets, too. They're ready to move on your command."
"Yeah, go ahead," Sarah heard her father's voice say.
"Dad, what do you think about deploying the Marines to watch the Watchers?"
That was a slip, she thought. "I never call them Marines."
"That would be my call," he assured her. "Don't want to look like the wimps on the block, do we?"
Sarah was not too thrilled about having these new guests there, and plus, she needed to resupply or they were all going to be in trouble.
"I'll make our intent known to Rayleigh. Don't do anything until I've had a chance to tell her."
John signed off and left CIC. He had already been to engineering, thanking the 2 naval officers there for having operated the reactor in manual. If it had been an automatic, which is the way it was supposed to be, the ship would be stranded with no hope for rescue. The lockdown would have destroyed the control board that was embedded in the shielding for the uranium core. The reactor would have scrammed and then killed itself. As it was, the only thing that was needing replacing was going to be a shitload of step relays.
"Ooh, I bet Rachel is one pissed off puppy right now," he thought.
CIC was next to storage, where the pod was going to be docking very soon. In the area stood 10 battle-ready cadets in body armor, just waiting. John opened the access door from engineering and floated into the room. They all turned to look.
"Brown, get your troops in order. I'd like to inspect them, if you will."
A quick bark from Jerry, and the 10 cadets formed up and stood at attention. They had been practicing this for months. After the armor came out and the suits modified, they practiced different stances and looks for being at attention. They knew what they liked.
"You are some intimidating badasses, aren't you?"
To John's surprise, they responded as one.
"Yes, sir,"
came the shout. Unable to resist, he had seen too many movies portraying the man in charge, giving a motivating assessment of his troops, and the growl accompanying the admiring grin was heard by all of them.
"Intimidating badasses," he emphasized.
John stopped in front of Amy Grant and addressed her.
"Grant," he began,
"why do you think it is that I call you Marines?" She thought she knew, but could not find the right words.
"Why do you think I call Sarah Captain? Is she a captain?"
"No, sir, she is not," came the reply.
"I guess you do it because that's what you need her to be."
"Exactly, exactly," he complimented.
"I call you Marines because that's what I need you to be. You're not some wet-nosed cadets out of training. You and your mates have been honing skills no one else has, and if the captain needs you to protect this ship, I expect those skills are going to come into play. If you want, you can be cadets on your own damn time. But I need you to be Marines all the time. Understand?"
"Yes, sir,"
came the cry from 10 individuals with overinflated egos.
"It's not like you are being asked to secure me a cup of coffee from that gunship over there, though I think you lot could pull it off."
Chuckles broke out and a few nods. "If called upon, it will be a show of force. But that show of force needs to be tempered. First and foremost, I need you to be diplomats. Your presence needs to be felt as a peacekeeping force,
not some crazy lunatics who only want to kill something. However, if they insist on bringing out the crazy, then God help them. That's all I can say, John said, looking admiringly at the cadets. Intimidating badass diplomats. John relaxed the group and confirmed weapon status. Live rounds. What could go wrong, he wondered. But it was not like that was anything new. Everyone on the ship wore a sidearm that was loaded. This was just the first time an alien species was going to find out about it. He broke them into two groups. 6 would deploy, and 4 would remain to tend the ship. This brought on a few sour faces. Look, seeing the disappointment. The IP is still coming on board. The thing is out of air. We are not trying to overwhelm them, simply match their numbers. And I want as many of you here on this ship as I can get, in case one of them tries something stupid, like stealing my coffee cup. Got it, Marines? A quick grin was followed with an appraising look at each of the young recruits. About this time, Sarah's voice came over the speaker. Cadet Brown, are you there?
Yes, Captain,
she acknowledged. John smiled.
Status. 2 teams. 6 peacekeepers for the IP and 4 on patrol here on the Calico,
she said, looking over at John West for his approval. He liked what he heard.
Who's your pilot?
Romy's in the skiff now.
Romy, are you up?
Right here, Sarah.
You sure you want to do this?
I've been shuttling these guys around for months.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay, is Dad there?
I'm right here, Sarah. Just looking over these badass warriors of yours.
Get them loaded and standing by. Raleigh is just getting a suit that she can use to communicate directly with that ship, so it will not be long.
Marines, are you ready for this? She asked.
Yes, sir.
The response was crisp.
CIC, are you online?
Go ahead, Captain.
When the skiff launches, you track it with targeting radar.
How are we with weapons? She inquired, already knowing the answer.
All weapons operational, Sarah.
Good. I want a 5-inch and 2 harpoons deployed and ready to shoot at a moment's notice. Understood?
We'll need to be at red alert.
The reminder stiffened her resolve.
You hear that, Bridge? Sarah called out.
The words, red alert, echoed through the ship as the mood lighting changed to accommodate.
Are we targeting anything other than the skiff? Queried CIC.
Don't point your weapons unless they do something to warrant it. But if they target lock the skiff, you return the favor and adjust your aim accordingly. Understood?
Understood.
John looked at the 6 cadets preparing to leave for the skiff.
Hear that, Marines? We got your back.
He then went over to a panel and pulled up the scheduled flight path that Romy had filed for the skiff.
Romy, mind if I make a slight change to your course you logged?
No, John, go ahead. I'll look it over and get back to you.
Moments later, he heard a stifled guffaw and the words,
Okay, new flight plan loaded.
Okay,
Sarah's voice erupted over the speaker system.
Calico, you're clear to launch the Marines.
Not waiting for permission? John inquired.
I didn't ask.
John started making his way back to the bridge. Candace needed a break. The skiff decoupled and pulled away from the cutout in the side of the Calico. It started the long parabolic path that eventually crossed 100 meters in front of the Talon gunship. A powerful beam of light followed the skiff during closest approach, but once John highlighted the Talon bridge with the Calico spotlight, theirs was suddenly extinguished.
Well, I'm glad we got that straight, John thought to himself as he unclenched his butt cheeks.
The skiff containing 7 nervous occupants arrived at the IP. Raldi had already moved the guards to one end of the odd-shaped tube, and they watched as the cadets exited gracefully from the open door of the craft to the surface of the IP outer hull. There were now 12 heavily armed but relaxed soldiers looking each other over with curiosity and respect. The good doctor's video display showed 2 completely different suited individuals, both menacing, but both looking good.
Calico Archives.
Yes, Dad, I know.
Sarah was getting impatient with his impatience. So what are we waiting on now?
If I understand Raleigh correctly, the captain of that big ship is on his way over here. He wants to know that it's safe, I guess.
Just then a call came from CIC.
The shuttle is departing their ship again, Bridge.
Fine. Tell them to hurry up.
John needed a break. I'm too old for this crap, he convinced himself. Was heard from the speaker. An alien from the damaged ship suited up and moved outside through the airlock to meet with the guards and escort the dignitary and security detail back inside the IP. Entering the compartment, the newcomers saw the relieved faces of the stranded space travelers, something not visible through the active light shield of the IP hull. Once its helmet was removed, the VIP was greeted with obvious respect and good cheer. It seemed that he wanted to talk to everyone in the group, and they all seemed eager to acquiesce to his wishes. Sarah stood on the other side of the glass with her arms crossed, taking in this momentous occasion.
We are in the process of making friends with an alien species, and who knows what that could mean.
These happy thoughts were disrupted by a call over the speaker system.
Tell that clown to either get his overdressed Boy Scouts in the pod with him so everyone can take a little ride, or tell them all to get the hell off the ship, Sarah.
This had startled the newcomer, along with the two guards that accompanied him inside the IP. Sarah knew things had to happen faster than they were, or her dad was going to have a coronary.
Overdressed Boy Scouts.
She shook her head and chuckled. But then Sarah looked at Raleigh and started rolling her fingers in a way they both understood. Raleigh was also getting used to the voice on the speaker, and it appeared to be getting more and more anxious. After a little flurry of back-and-forth alien conversation, everyone was finally inside, and Marty was firing up the thrust unit. It took 15 minutes, but the pod was finally berthed, and hoses were getting hooked up. Once inside, Marty adjusted the active panel on the IP unit became transparent, allowing the aliens to see four additional soldiers stationed around the inside perimeter. Sarah was having further discussions with Raleigh, and after a time, using the visual wall, she got her point across. The discussion did not take long between the apparent captains of the alien fleet, and it was agreed upon to proceed. Sarah had the main door closed and the supply area pressurized. A much-appreciated escape from their confines in the tube, the 14 alien beings and their new security team began roaming around the vastly greater space that storage provided. They were also examining the pieces of equipment that were still kept there. Most of the stuff that normally filled the space had been left on the two asteroids, which they had abandoned several days prior, patiently waiting their return. The two alien captains were inside the hospital area, pointing at different items and talking amongst themselves, when Pashinik II ventured in to give thanks to her would-be rescuer. She was up and about, packing her little bundle of joy around with her. The discussion quickly centered around her place of origin, the move that she and her mate were making to the new colony world, and the work they were meant to do there.
Nina Tam is certainly taking an interest in her. I wonder why that is, Raleigh speculated.
Same group, perhaps.
Maybe genetically connected.
She did not know, but yes, he is extremely interested.
That little meeting broke up when Sarah introduced her father to the group. Marty had gotten the point across that they were the first extraterrestrial beings that the people from Earth had encountered. Simple greetings were exchanged, and because of the atmospheric similarities the two species shared, John convinced Sarah to give the two captains a walk through the ship. So the little tour began with Misha and Marty pulling up the rear, all wearing particulate masks to at least provide a modicum of protection. As they left the confines of supply, they began moving forward through engineering and finally stopping on the ring, where they all enjoyed some water and tested out the hot coffee that John had gotten from the galley.
The aliens started a dialogue amongst themselves that Marty tried and failed to understand.
Something about the mother, Pishinik 2.
That's it? John shot back. You're a big help.
Misha managed to do a bit better. Make one human from Tayashoba here.
She pointed both index fingers at the floor, as Marty had shown her.
I taught her that, Marty beamed.
So they want to bring another person over, is that about it? John asked, to no one in particular.
Sarah and Raleigh were busy drawing pictures on the table of the conference room, and finally, Sarah had worked it out.
Their arrival on the bridge was a shock, but the proximity allowed for the radio in Nina Tam's suit to penetrate the windows set about the bridge, allowing him to contact his ship. After a quick discussion, the Calico moved alongside the Tayashoba, and one of the aliens was being prepped to make its way over to the Calico. It seemed the skiff was in constant motion as James and Talis worked to repair the damage inflicted on the transport ship. The two occupants had just finished making a part for the generator coupling and were leaving the Calico to try it out when the call came in. The detour found the skiff sitting on a spacious deck that held several menacing-looking vessels. Sleek and painted black, they reminded James of military jet fighters, with completely different wings and engines. He had the cameras and passive sensors recording everything while they sat there, waiting on the fare. Once secured, they made a beeline back to the skiff's little perch, dropped off the passenger, and then headed back over to the broken transport.
Time to fire this baby up, Jim thought with a smile on his face.
Trax was usually happy, but this search and rescue mission was cutting into his leave, and with his mate soon to have their firstborn, he did not want to miss it. She was to be transported off-world to the new colony and would be there by now. Because of the baby, his station was reassigned with her on the planet, allowing Pishinik 2 to continue her work while they were both available to raise the child.
But now, I am here. Why? Minding a couple of troublemakers from an old supply hauler? Why me? Fine. I'm not doing anything right now, seeing as my ship is on the other side of the system and I'm just a passenger. Fine, Trax told himself.
He did not have far to go. The skiff's little docking bay was just outside the supply room, and as he passed through the door into the open area, he was greeted by the captain of the Tayashoba and shown into what looked like a medical area. Pishinik, too, was just finishing the baby's cleaning.
I can't wait to get back to gravity, she contemplated the idea. A newborn in space is particularly challenging.
The door to the room opened, and as she turned to look, their eyes met.
Well, that was fun, John said to the same group, sitting around the conference room table.
The couple and the baby were relocated to the guest room. In fact, they were the first guests in the guest room, and several items were brought over from the Tayashoba in celebration. The baby had found pleasure in returning to some form of gravity and promptly fell asleep in the cozy bassinet James had printed out.
You beacon,
Misha passed along the inquiry from Nina Tam.
Misha had seen the movie play out when they first met, but she wanted Nina Tam to see it too. As the video played, grunts could be heard coming from the aliens at different times. When the ship appeared, John was certain that he had heard his first alien cuss words.
I have to ask him about that sometime, he smiled to himself.
Maisha, what is that? John asked, pointing to the ship causing so much angst.
She began a laborious task of trying to explain in picture. The three Talons sat in collaboration, talking, pointing, but basically agreeing on a final product, and so Miesha and Marty started a back-and-forth dialogue that ended in a low whistle.
Marty, don't do that again, please.
John's comment made him look up and saw that both he and Sarah were looking uncomfortably at the guests.
Chalkboards and fingernails, I'm guessing.
Marty looked over at the aliens,
apologized in their native tongue, and dove in.
Well, you can see here that the Talons are not up to the same technical level as the Rumorians. That's the closest pronunciation I can get.
Yes, I gathered. Keep going, John prompted.
So I believe the Rumorians are in the other star system. It's a binary system, so there are two stars.
James held up two fingers for clarity.
I see. It was something that he and the rest of the crew had seen for quite a while now. Well, there are these raiding parties that have been disabling their supply vessels like this one here. They know that the crews will try and get rescued, so these traps are set up to catch other ships, too. They take all the supplies and the people and abandon the broken vessels so they can be repaired and the process begins again.
Well, why didn't they take this lot, then? Asked Sarah.
Some back and forth got the point across. They found that if the reactor and the supply vessels fracture, the Rumorians tend to leave them alone and then go after any other ships that show up to help. So the Talons began installing units on the hull that could emit large amounts of radiation if attacked, basically to simulate a reactor meltdown. This is the first time it was used. Seems to work, but I'm betting they catch on to that little ruse pretty quick. Marty paused.
So they don't know where their people are being taken? Sarah asked.
No, they think it's the other system, but their ships aren't capable of chasing. The Tyashoba can stand up to the raiding ships, but not catch them. So anyway, that's about it. They lose more and more of their people to the raiders, and there's not much they can do about it.
Do they want to? Asked John.
I'm sorry, John. What do you mean?
Do they want to do something about it?
Calico Archives. There is no individual to single out as the spark that ignited the battle taking place between the humans and the Talons. But the dead that mounted on the side of the humans could most definitely be attributed to one person, John West. At the start of the campaign, the cadets looked to him for the inspiration and cunning that would be needed to defeat the seasoned opponent. Unfortunately, they chose wrong. His latest disaster was viewed as a friendly fire incident, but the words still rang in his mind.
Open your eyes, man!
John knew he had screwed up the moment he pulled the trigger. The result of his bad judgment had sacrificed two of his own cadets, while the only Talon fighter in the vicinity only received a glancing blow from the assault. Nina Tam was staring at him with ferocity. The counterattack would be coming, and John could not know if the retaliation would leave him with all his troops down, or maybe, just maybe, there would be survivors left to continue the fight. The ship had been watching. They saw what he had done. He had let them down, and now he and the crew of the Calico awaited their fate.
Oh my God, you missed everything!
John stood there, his open palms gesturing towards the zone of death, as he taunted his counterpart.
How could you possibly miss everything?
Shaking his head in disbelief and chuckling, John slammed his hand against the red button, and after the machine reset, the door opened. Nina Tam saw the look of total disregard that John wore, and it made him even more furious than the results of his actions. He shouted to his battle-hardened troops, and in a language not understood by the humans, obviously blamed someone else for his own failures. For Sarah, it was about the safety of her ship and crew. One misstep, one thing overlooked, and the ship could be damaged at best, destroyed with all hands lost at worst. She had to put an end to this crap, and she had to do it now. The yell was loud and long. Her father had just succeeded, as opposed to his recent past, which was littered with failure. Two of the Talons were down, taken out entirely, leaving only two remaining in the tube, each one struggling with the knowledge that they might be next.
You tested it? She stated flatly.
Yes, I tested it,
James' face showed concern. Nina Tam doesn't seem put out at all. Only more determined.
When did you test it?
Sarah asked as another volley was fired.
James, look at me. When did you test it?
Her anger was beginning to show. The explosion of sound from the talons was deafening. Sarah did not need to look. Her father had lost again. If he had just taken her advice and stopped screwing around, maybe the people on the Calico, who loved and cherished the man, would still love and cherish him. Right then, they were pissed. Nina Tam faced John, holding up both hands. He extended two fingers on one and one finger on the other. A loud grunt from Nina Tam was followed by his team grunting three times.
Yeah, we'll see about that, John told him.
Reset, he yelled.
When did you test it, James?
For a few minutes, she would not have to talk over the noise.
I tried it out on the way back to the moon after we took on the load of fuel at Deimos.
He started to feel uncomfortable, as it finally dawned on him that she was scrutinizing his actions.
On the way to the moon.
Once again, her voice was flat.
Yeah, we had the extra space because all the mining gear was still at the transfer hub, so I tried it out.
Without testing the idea beforehand? You know, someplace other than the inside of a spaceship?
The words sent a shiver up her spine. James got a look of disbelief on his face.
Of course it got tested, Sarah. I would never do something like that. My dad built it on Earth, then I printed out the bearings in the shop.
You wouldn't do something like that, but you would do something like this and not tell anyone?
Her hand drifted in the general direction of pure pandemonium. With the help from the Talons, the hospital outer shell of the IP had been removed and stored. The inside tube was suspended on each end by a hanger bearing assembly that James had printed out months before. Forced air was used not only as the bearings, but also as the driving force to spin the tube up to 1/3 Earth gravity in the storage area of the ship.
Well, I told the reactor guys they'd see a spike in power, James croaked, trying to defend a weak position.
A Talon guard stepped into the Marine catapult and the door closed. He was ready. But Nina Tam was so busy criticizing the human for his inferior skill set that he failed to notice. John West, on the other hand, was having none of it.
The reactor guys helped assemble the unit, I'm guessing?
Sarah asked as her gaze slewed back towards the spinning tube.
Yeah, they helped, and the guys at refueling.
The guys who delivered up the mining equipment helped take it apart.
I see, she muttered as her attention was drifting.
And who thought this up?
She asked as her concentration was drawn away by the action.
Well, for me, I just wanted to be able to have the gravity. The rest was the cadets.
Well, except for the catapults. Those are your dad's handiwork. You know, after the cadets started using up all the hydrogen peroxide for the thrust units on the suits. Sarah recognized that the hydrogen peroxide was part of the reaction jet the suits used. When pumped into the catalyst chamber, the peroxide interacts with the potassium permanganate, instantly transforming into a high-temperature steam which shoots out the nozzle and provides thrust. To conserve supplies, John built the catapults, which were nothing more than a piston driven by compressed nitrogen. An electric motor would pull the piston into place, forcing the nitrogen back into the pressure vessel on the side of the unit. Once down and locked, a suited-up cadet would step into the cage and close the door, thereby arming the device. Then it was a simple matter to aim the tube in the direction of desired flight and press the button, just like Nina Tam was doing at that very moment. His aim was 1/3 of the way down the tube. The 5 Talons and 5 human guards were randomly scattered throughout, held tight to the floor by the centripetal force of the spinning tube, each facing away from the catapult. As the 6th human guard waited next to John,
The lock released, and the high-pressure nitrogen rushed into the cylinder. This quickly drove the piston and the attached platform to its limits, causing a Talon guard to shoot out the end at about 10 miles an hour. He was floating towards his target, arms and legs outstretched, in the hopes of knocking down as many of the human aggressors as possible. The impact occurred at the legs of Sean Dancing, and he went end over end, spiraling through several armored bodies, suddenly impacting with a Talon who was immediately dropped. Cheers echoed throughout the ship as the cannon fodder and dead were removed from the tube. The baby, unfazed by all the commotion, suddenly became startled by her mother's obvious objection to Nina Tam's aiming technique. The catapult was reset and Terry climbed in.
"Do not use the Force. Try this time," she chastised.
John turned to the assembled audience and shouted, "Terry wants me to use the Force again," resulting in a resounding "No!" from the human spectators. John's aim was slightly higher, and now the waiting game. The spinning drum could throw off the senses, but John was ready, and as the target came into view one more time, he pressed the button.
"You can't make adjustments to the ship without..."
Sarah's warning was cut short. A cheer went up. Terry bounced off one of her own, but he never lost his footing. She tumbled several times before cutting a Talon's legs out from underneath him. He was gone.
"I'm saying I won't allow you to make changes to the ship without authorization. It must be logged, and I want to know about it. Do we understand each other?"
The humans lost a best-of-five series, but not without a fight. Later, after things settled down, the guards could be heard asking Nina Tam if they could get one of those things on their ship. Calico Archives. James had called in to let everyone know the supply vessel was back up and running. The fitting he had made worked, and they were just transferring the last of the O2. "The crew can make their way back over any time," he spoke with pride. "You and Talus have done some damn fine work, young man." John's compliment was mimicked by Sarah and Marty. Pointing to a picture of the vessel and a quick thumbs up was all Raleigh needed. The excitement in the room was abundant. Also, the group was close to hatching a plan. It would require all three ships to work, but it seemed doable. Dr. Schubert had just left the room to set up a test and get a feel for what was being asked of his equipment, but the request seemed straightforward.
"I should have this working inside of a day," he told himself.
Sarah was getting keyed up about the prospects of what their plan entailed.
"Are you sure you don't want to run this by the president first?"
Sarah asked her father. "We're here now. The idea of traveling that distance and back just to get the okay? No. If you're up for it, between the two of us, we should be able to convince the rest."
"We may have to use one of the duds. That'll make her mad."
"She can take it out of my pay," John fired back. Right then, he did not give a damn about what the president thought.
6 days until we're supposed to leave," Sarah cautioned. Then she said, "Are you really thinking about retiring?"
"Thinking about it? Yeah. I know the company will be in good hands when I do," he said with a knowing smile.
"Well, I'm going to start asking around, get a feel for the mood." "This is going way off script," Sarah pointed out.
"I'll be in my room for a while." Upon getting up, she activated her comm unit. "James, Shannon, come see me in my room, please." With the blessing of the crew, the plan started to take shape. The Calico was moved to its position, and the pieces of the IP moved back outside. The inner and outer tubes were separated, with the clinic resting against the hull and protruding out the back of the Calico. The inner tube was fixed to the side facing the location the ship most likely would appear, set at an angle and made to look like it had been torn from the mounting brackets. A series of smoke bombs were positioned around the point where the bent tube touched the Calico's hull to aid in the illusion once the fun started. The Talons had a painting scheme the humans couldn't match, whereby a photo could be transferred to a surface using location markers for orientation and scale. It used a paint sprayer designed to read the location of the nozzle with respect to the markers and kick out the right color. All the operators had to do was sit back and watch. Dr. Schubert provided the image he thought best represented what the hole in the supply ship would look like from the expected location that the Rumorian ship would occupy upon its arrival. This image was then put on the newly repaired hole. Once complete, it looked like it had when the Calico first arrived. Very nice, thought John admiringly. What's the holdup? Could be heard over the speaker system. Waiting on James again, Sarah's voice replied. Just hooking up the power unit for the spare step relay. Should be ready in a jiffy, James piped up eagerly. He was having a blast. The 3D printed bumps each sported 3 cameras, and there were 2 bumps under construction. Affixing them to the hull meant using a sticky resin designed to seal cracks and holes that hopefully never occurred. The delivery system was constructed from the maneuvering jets stripped from 2 of the remaining auto drills. Once everything was in position and tested, the final meeting took place on the Calico. The plan involves Nina Tam, captain of the warship Tyashoba, to remain with the Calico along with 2 of his guards. Maisha had also been requested for the trip. The rest of the Talons had said their goodbyes, along with their thanks, to the humans, and they made their way back to their respective ships. The Talon supply ship, apparently broken, lay against an asteroid with a gaping hole in its side. The Tyashoba was only just visible as it lay in wait on the same asteroid. Then there was what appeared to be a fatally wounded Calico in the open void near to where the Talon beacon had been. "Shannon, let's go," came the order from the command chair. "Aye, Captain," responded Shannon with a devilish grin. Sarah squirmed at the obvious jab. The smoke was the first in a series of steps, followed by the recorded change in frequency, and finally, the transmitter was turned off and given a break. They knew where to look. The point of light was still there. Depending on how fast the ship moved, the point might still be there when the ship arrived. And it did. The Rumorians retreated to the view of the supply ship, still dead, and the crew by now the same.
"What have we here? That does not look like any Talon ship. That might be a new species. A large ship. Probably 3 times the number, and obviously damaged. Very damaged. Let us go see what kind of technology they have for us, and maybe some good workers. There may be a promotion in this capture."
The Rumorian ship began to advance on the distressed Calico, when out of nowhere, the shots from the Tyashoba hit home, followed by another barrage that shook the ship to its core. Moments later, it was gone, burning hard for who knows where, and carrying with it 2 small bumps that were painted the same color as the ship they were stuck to. Attention to detail was important to the creator of the devices. After the raiders' departure, the remaining Talons watched as the supply vessel and its escort powered up and began the trip back to the colony world.
"If what I suspect is true, there is a good chance this Calico will be the first to arrive," Nina Tam told himself.
Calico Archives. The planned day to depart for Earth came and went, but the realization was lost on everyone, as their wild plan to assist the Talons was playing out. The Calico had been moved to an area far away from where the ships had been gathered, so that if the Rumorians reappeared, there would be plenty of space between them. One of the things that Maisha did not understand was why the ship no longer had the ability to see the information that had been available when they first met. Marty tried to explain the radio was broken, but that confused things even more. The speed that the Talon ships were capable of was far less than that of light, so to say the radio broke implied that the humans were from a planet close by. This was certainly not the case, as there were not any habitable planets close by. They knew that the doctor that had assisted in the surgery wasn't on the vessel. So how did they communicate in real time? All the talents had watched the procedure and knew that the man on the screen was directing the surgery. Maisha's confusion only strengthened Nina Tam's belief that this species was far more advanced than they were. Truly, how far away was this planet called Earth? Nina Tam asked Maisha. It took a meeting to finally agree to provide the distance, and when they were told, the truth sounded like a lie. I can show them star maps that I have in my archive, Dr. Schubert offered. Thanks, Doc. But those are not for distribution to any other species. You don't want a Vogon battle fleet suddenly showing up at Earth, do you? Oh, yes, of course. Smiling, he caught the reference. Sarah, you there?
Yep.
I'm getting some fluctuating mass tension readings on the board. It might be our friends returning. Hard to say. If it is them, the drive they are using does not work like ours, that's for sure. Okay, Shannon. CIC, do you see what she sees?
Shannon's here with us now.
Gotcha. The tension board indicated that the masses were oscillating between step 2 and 3.
Same problem we had trying to get to 3, Shannon speculated. Only they seemed to be running a lot faster than we were able to.
Their means of adding mass is different from ours, John was speculating now.
How long? Sarah broke the spell.
Any second. Looks like 3 ships, the excited voice from CIC cried out. They appeared amongst a happy group of auto drills, hopping from one asteroid to the next, looking for a good drill point. The radio spectrum was filled with the news about the soft soil one had located, while the second unit chirped excitedly about having touched down. The built-in AIs all had something to tell the other units about their lives, but becoming mixed in with the information about drilling and moving was a tiny signal that several of the units could hear and amplify. This information had to do with the starfield data 2 identical bumps had been tasked with getting.
Okay, we're syncing up, the doctor's voice was heard saying. Downloading.
They see us. They know we're here, Sarah said. Immediately, the ships began advancing on the new quarry, but the Calico managed to stay just out of reach. After they had got enough data from the adversary ship, the Calico finally ducked into the denser area of the asteroid belt and then disappeared. Because of the need to conserve fuel, the Calico had taken nearly 14 hours to get to the location the starfield photos indicated was the last place the Raider ship had visited for any length of time. Regem is what the Talons called it, a planet that according to them was shared by both systems. Its fate was questionable, as it was in the process of diving towards a neighboring star at a faster and faster velocity. Being a gas giant, the Birkeland current between the 2 stars had energized the gas to the glow mode, and it was shown with a bluish hue. Regem also had several exceptionally large moons associated with it. According to Nina Tam, these moons had not been visible for several hundred years because of the bright plasma sheath had enveloped all 4 bodies. Maisha looked out the window, in awe of what had just happened. There was the pale color that surrounded the ship, and suddenly, Regem.
How is such a thing possible? She asked herself.
Nina Tam merely accepted what he suspected all along. Envy was the emotion he felt. I'm telling you, Sarah, we need to get closer. The doctor's photos of the planet, or moon, or whatever, is much closer than we are right now.
But Dad, she cautioned, will we be able to get back out?
There's a huge magnetic field being generated and a lot of electrical forces at work.
Sure. Going to step and hit the gas.
We'll go somewhere, even if it's not exactly where we expect.
Not a problem. We'll jump right out, he added optimistically.
But he wasn't really sure his bullshit line was convincing anyone, especially himself. The moons turned out to be planet-sized bodies, roughly the size of Venus. They all lay on a path that followed Regem. Like a locomotive running down the tracks, the glowing gas giant was pulling its three smaller cousins along behind it. The four of them were electrically locked together and accelerating towards Talon's sister star. A star, not visible inside the glowing plasma sheath of her gem. "I believe it is the last of the planets," the doctor speculated. "You can see the color is closer to the photo."
"Sounds good, Doc," John said appreciatively.
The step test proved successful, and they were able to maintain their course even in this region of electrical chaos. As the Calico approached the fourth planet, the optics located a single vessel in orbit around the body. Plotting the trajectory, the Calico assumed the same orbit, but on the opposite side, hidden from sight. The surface view that the cameras afforded were impressive, and the planet's rotational speed was so fast that they could examine the entire surface once every 6 hours. Hotspots became obvious, and the crew concentrated the search in those areas with earnest. The Talon people, visible on the screen, were quarrying material from the local rock formations. There were several large encampments set up for the workers, and the cameras also picked out what appeared to be guards. Judging by their appearance, they were probably automated. More than one occasion saw a sentry approach an individual, elevate a staff high in the air, and point with a finger. The first time the onlookers saw the process, it made no sense. But as John became more aware of the environment, he thought that he understood.
"I don't get it," Sarah remarked when a sudden flash of light from the finger dropped one of the workers to its knees.
The worker slowly began to move and got to its feet. "There is so much electrical potential between the ground and what? How high is that staff? Maybe 30 feet? The guard electrocuted the worker. Didn't kill him, obviously, but knocked him down hard.
Okay.
Well, they're using the high potential energy developed by the plasma between the four planets to aid in the work.
Interesting."
John enclosed an area on the screen and pressed save. "See how they're using another electrode over there to basically melt the rock? They are actually cutting sections of rock out of the cliff face using nothing but the electrical current harvested from the atmosphere. You can just make out an insulated cable snaking down from on top of that ridge. See that?" John pointed to the screen capture.
"Look at this," Dr. Schubert cried out.
The image showed the same encampment as before, but from a different angle.
"Are those obelisks? I don't..."
His words trailed off as the screen updated with other similar structures.
"It's starting to look like some of the ancient megalithic sites on the Earth," he continued.
"I think they might be using them as lightning rods, Doc," John said as his understanding of the evidence became clearer.
"Lightning rods?" Candace exclaimed.
"The intense charges that are built up in the atmosphere will eventually cause huge lightning strikes. If you have tall, sharp-tipped lightning rods around, it will help dissipate some of the local high-voltage energy into the ground. Then the occupants aren't as likely to get fried. And if you make it out of rock, the rod probably acts like a regulator. The voltage would dissipate slower than it would from a metal rod. Plus, it could take quite a wallop and not get destroyed."
"What?"
The doctor was trying to follow his logic. The outrageous path John's mind was taking.
"Wait, are you trying to say that this kind of thing may have happened on Earth?"
"It's just a guess, Doc, but yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. It wouldn't surprise me to find out that it was the same culture that did it."
"Bombole!"
Maisha nearly shouted, pointing at the display. There, situated between three tall rock obelisks, sat a box, and suddenly the excited conversation of the humans were drowned out by the equally excited voices of the four Talons.
"Is that what I think it is?"
Sarah's voice was barely above a whisper.
"Looks like it," her father replied.
Coaxing the Talons for an explanation, Marty finally gave his appraisal.
They seem to be saying that the boxes are used for an alarm or something." Jeez, Marty. Sarah was ahead of him with this translation. I think the goop inside blows up and the lids pop off. That's the alarm you're referring to.
Okay, so what does that mean? Marty questioned.
I don't know. Can we get a better look at the people, Doctor? Sarah asked.
The next settlement. I'll start zooming in and get the display right.
It was the tattoo scarring that gave it away. The talons had once again entered a fitful state, and Marty was doing his best to get answers.
I think he's an official. They got lost on one of the raids. He was going to the colony world when he and a bunch of them got scooped up.
Dad, you notice how there doesn't seem to be any sentries around? They only seem to be with the workers doing the mining. This guy looks like he's cutting up some vegetables. See that?
She was right.
Doc, is there any way to calibrate your gear to detect the sentries? John asked hopefully.
Well, the robots, if they are robots, seem to have a much hotter core temp. All the heat sources are being mapped, but I will need to zoom out to confirm. May I?
His wish was granted, and the machines began to get maps separate from the talons.
The skiff could make the trip, Dad, Sarah prodded.
It's 1/4 Earth gravity. We could drop in, grab one or two prisoners, and be back in time for dinner.
John looked hard at his daughter.
It's not our fight, you know that, right?
Sarah said nothing, just looked at him as he looked at her. Even the Talons could tell that something was being argued between the two of them as they sat mute, staring at one another. Nina Tam was hopeful.
Calico Archives.
Nope, you're not going. You are in charge of the entire crew, and that means you take as few risks as possible. Rami's been practicing this maneuver, without permission, I might add, so she and the Marines are used to it.
Rami, are you up for this? Sarah asked.
Ready now. Let's go.
Rami, this is an atmosphere you're entering, completely different from an asteroid, John advised.
Yes, John, I've got this.
Two Talon guards and two of the cadets would accompany her. It was not known what to expect, but both Sarah and Nina Tam made it noticeably clear. In and out. Leave no trace. Get no more than 5, then get back up here. The rotation of the planet meant that the best time to watch the extraction would be in 40 minutes. There would be no armor. In fact, the makeshift covering that the rescuers wore needed to be dirtied up significantly once they landed, if there was any hope of blending in. The two cadets had been instructed to provide backup only.
Don't try and be a hero and get left behind. If those other ships suddenly show up, then there is no telling what will happen.
They understood, and each repeated the orders to John, who was not feeling good about this idea at all. As the craft began its descent, Rami kept adjusting the velocities until she was directly over the drop point, and then the steps began. It took 6 adjustments to get the vessel to the point where the thrust unit could provide the braking necessary to land the craft. Touching down on another world, the skiff was greeted by a very loud crack as the high voltage built up on the shell from the upper atmosphere flowed into the ground. This was something that John had anticipated, so a series of carbon fiber rods were attached to the hull in such a way that they would take the brunt of the discharge. The discharge caused the rods to evaporate. With the skiff on the ground, the door was opened and the 4 clandestine infiltrators could be seen from the optics on Calico, throwing dirt on each other and rubbing the soil into the garments. After which, they began the 2-mile trek to the location where the Prime Minister of the colony world was busy preparing a meal for the wretched souls who were his friends. Rami knew that if commanded, she would have to leave them behind. She had left people behind before, but that was always an act, a play, where the outcome involved everyone getting together after it was all over and laughing at the mistakes that had been made. Her palms were sweaty as she waited, alone in the vehicle with no communication to her companions, silent as the grave. It was likely that the approach had been heard by someone, but as John pointed out, the fireworks that were happening regularly aided in the illusion. It did not take the soldiers long to cover the distance to the encampment. There was vegetation and some scrubby trees, but for the most part, the area lacked cover. The humans stayed behind about a kilometer from the target and watched the two guards from Nina Tam's ship make the approach. The pulses were racing, not only on the ground, but high above, looking down. "How much time, Doc?" John asked impatiently.
15 minutes, unless you make an adjustment."
"Looks like they made contact."
"Oh yeah, sure did," Marty said.
A flurry of activity, and then a different result than expected. One of the guards could be seen carrying a Talon back towards the cadets. Then the second guard appeared and moved in the same direction.
"Okay," John said to no one.
The skiff made it back on board the Calico less than an hour later. The injured Talon had obviously suffered a severe electrical burn, possibly a lightning strike. The burn marks were ugly as they stretched up the arm and across the chest. He was conscious, however, and excited. John looked over at Marty and said, "It's time to go." The colony planet was well defended, as was proof by the number of ships that swarmed the Calico upon its arrival. The Teoshoba had arrived earlier that day, and the crew of the supply vessel was being swapped along with the passengers. Nina Tam contacted the security net, and Calico was given a berth. Bashunik 2 and Trax were aboard the shuttle that was taking them to the offload site when the Calico made port.
"They are just arriving?" she thought to herself. "I expected that ship to be faster than that."
Trax was talking to the man sitting on the opposite side of him.
"Kenaho," he said, pointing out the window at the newly arrived vessel.
"Dad, how is it you seem to know what they're saying?" Sarah demanded.
"Marty and Misha can't get their stories straight, and you stand there nodding your head like you've spoken their language all your life."
"Well, once you figure out how to cross the X's and dot the sentences, it's pretty straightforward." John smiled at his confused daughter.
"It's a story, sweetie. All these documents they keep coming up with. What's the one thing that stands out about them?" he asked.
"I don't know. They all look old to me."
"Exactly. From a previous age. We have things like that on Earth, too," John continued. "Inscriptions and passages that speak of fire and brimstone, the stars reversing course, nights that go on for days and days, great walls of water, floods, manna from heaven, stone drawing of events that undoubtedly were celestial in nature, manuscripts from around the world that speak the same language of destruction. It's there if you're willing to look."
"So what are you saying? The same thing happened on Earth as what happened to the Talons or Regem or whatever the name of that planet is? I don't understand any of it."
He looked at her, then realized all of the other Earthlings in the room were showing the same symptoms. The light switch was still in the off position.
John walked over to the wall and began some simple drawings. "I'll try to explain what I think is going on, but until a better grasp of their language is available, we won't know for sure." He drew the system that they had just come from.
"What can you tell me about Regem?" he asked anybody.
"It glows a pretty color," Sarah threw out sarcastically.
"Correct. Any idea why?"
"Let me guess. A Birkeland current." A bit of sarcasm remained.
"Correct.
Regem is receiving enough power from the local Birkeland current to switch from dark mode plasma to glow mode plasma. Thus the glow. What else?"
"It used to belong to this system." Marty knew that fact, even if the rest was gibberish.
"Correct. The path of Regem has been known for a long time. Anything else?"
"It's going to crash into that star," Sarah guessed.
"I don't know if that's true, but it is falling into the gravity well. And what's happening while it does that?"
After a slight pause, he asked disappointedly, "No takers?"
"Regem and all the little Regems are becoming electrically charged," he explained, adding some symbols next to the drawings. There were some murmurs from the Talon audience.
"And?"
Sarah countered.
"Think of it this way. Shuffle across a carpet and touch the doorknob.
Zap, right? Now, imagine an entire planet becoming similarly charged and coming near other planets with a different charge level. Things are going to start happening. Let me ask you this. Do you think gravity is a pretty strong force? He inquired.
Yes, Sarah said defiantly.
Now, it's pretty weak. The electrical force is like 10 to the 36th times stronger. It's a big number. So charged bodies like the one we were just at are no longer concerned with the gravitational attraction being exerted by Rajem or each other. The electrical forces are going to drive the planets apart or move them closer together, depending on the charge. Then, if they get too close and they have unbalanced charges, just like the door handle, zap. John let that sink in for a bit.
So what's that got to do with the Talons and their people?
Shannon did not want to be left out of the conversation. I'm guessing, mind you. But maybe. Like what might have happened on Earth. Like what seems to have happened on Talon. And just like what appears to be happening on Rajem. A group of miners looks for systems that will have similar occurrences with planets, like what we are witnessing. Once the planets fall towards the star's plasma and charge sufficiently, they move in. Utilizing the stored energy, they begin extracting minerals from the planet using nothing more than the electrodes that are raised into the ionized atmosphere, just like what we saw. And when the danger exceeds a certain limit, the lids start popping off your granite boxes. When that happens, you simply pack up your sentries and get the hell out. And if you don't mind sacrificing labor, you simply abandon them. Marty was shaking his head. So you say the boxes are for what again? He was getting a headache. John retrieved his pad and pulled up a series of photos. The first one was a stone box that Miesha had pointed out on the mining planet, and seeing it again brought out a similar response from the Talons. Bobani, along with some additional chatter. Right. He then brought up a picture of the box that Sarah had hit with the Step 3 test rig. This brought on additional chattering. He then brought up a picture of one of the boxes at Saqqara, in Egypt, at a site called Serapeum. Nobody said anything. West then brought up a picture of the Giza Plateau and the Three Pyramids. The explosion of sound from the Talons was instant. They were all pointing and talking and pointing some more. The humans just watched. Only one of them thought something like this might happen. After the commotion was over, John addressed Marty's question, though by now, Marty had completely forgotten that he had even asked a question. Marty, I believe the material in the box is designed to change states when subject to a powerful electric charge. If I am right, it works like this. You have one of these calibrated granite boxes and you dump in a couple of different materials that do not react in their present state, be it solid or liquid. A charge is built up on the outside of the box, and if the charge exceeds a certain threshold, the material inside the box changes states. The components become hypergolic, and the mixture explodes. The explosion is sufficient to pop the top off the box, and on Earth, that is a 20 to 30 ton lid. Anyway, once these lids start popping, that means the charge is exceeding your safety limits and it's time to go. It's just a hypothesis, mind you. The human audience was staring at him. John had to admit to himself, it is quite a theory. The Talon audience, however, seemed pleased with his assessment. The wall he had been scrawling on was littered with potential.